Hi, Holly. Welcome to EarHacks FM.
Thank you. Welcome.
What was your first computer?
I think it was a K-Pro. It was a CPM machine.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this wasn't actually my first computer. It was my dad's first computer. Mm-hmm. But it was this amazing computer that was sort of designed to be, it was called transportable because it wasn't actually portable because it was well before laptops, but it sort of folded in half. So it had like it was like a laptop if a laptop was the size of a medium mm-hmm. suitcase. This machine, it was a CPM computer, and I didn't do much on it except that I played this game, and I have never since had a game that I enjoyed as much as this one.
What was it?
Even though it was, I can't remember the name of it, but it was a platform game, you know, sort of like,
uh-huh.
I think they're called platform games, like yeah. Donkey Kong, you know, where you sort of
okay.
go along. But of course it was only ASCII art. So you had this like little character, and then you would sort of, the platforms were made out of dashes, and then you would run along the platform. And then every now and then there would be a hole, and then you would sort of fall through the hole. And then there was like little chevrons that were used, and, you know, pipes that were used to make arrows that you would land on and you would kill. And it was so, I mean, if you would look at it now, it was so unbelievably simple, but it was still compelling.
A K-Pro was the name of the machine.
I think so, yeah. I'm just going to look that up while we're talking.
Never heard about it. But CPM. In Germany, there was CPM Schneider, I think. There was like a German computer. I think it was CPM. A CPM was the operating system, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And
it was K-Pro. So it's like K-A-Y Pro.
Oh, okay. And your dad was a programmer, developer.
He wasn't, no, not at all. He sort of studied education and that kind of thing, but he was an early adopter of computers, and so I really benefited from that.
Yeah, pretty cool. So what is your second game, or what was your first line of code on the K-Pro?
Oh, yeah, so I didn't ever get to code on the K-Pro, but then the next computer that we had was when I'm just sounding older and older and older, trip down memory lane. Because, of course, you know, then the sort of the home computers really started with the IBM PC, and then they really, really started with the clones of the IBM PC. So he got an IBM PC clone.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started programming in BASIC on that. And I ended up doing like something to like organize recipes or something like that.
Why you started coding?
I don't know. I think I've always liked making things. And so it was, you know, it was a new toy and it was a new way to make things.
Okay. And the recipe management system worked?
I don't think so, no. I got very far with it.
And you were able to store the stuff. This is this was the challenge.
Yeah.
Was the database involved, you know?
I don't think so, no. So I think it was probably, yeah, I can't even remember, but it was, I mean, it was not sophisticated. And I remember at the time, there was sort of all of this conversation about like, you know, these new computer things and what people will be using them for. And, you know, people will use them to manage recipes. And I, you know, tried writing this recipe management system and it was not very good. And it was very awkward. And of course, you'd be like cooking in one room and the computer would be in another room and you'd be running back. I mean, it was just, it didn't make sense in any kind of usability way. And I sort of used to laugh about it for quite a long time until, of course, now. All my cooking is done with recipes on the computer. So it's sometimes these things, you know, they take a while. There's this sort of early idea.
But different software, I guess. Or is it like your old software version 120 or something?
No, I mean, it's yeah, because it's all, you know, it's either just in text documents if I have a recipe of my own, or it's just, you know, there's this thing called the World Wide Web.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it is amazing the sort of the amount of content that we have for free mm-hmm. on the webs, most of which mm-hmm. is terrible, but some of which is really, really good.
And your recipe management system was still in BASIC or Turbo Pascal, something different?
It was BASIC, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so I did that BASIC programming. And then I did, I think I didn't touch it too much until university, when I did do Pascal in university.
Uh-huh. So you started computer science?
No, it was physics that I studied.
Wow.
And so we had to do one module on, I can't even remember what it was called, you know, computers for physics people.
And you enjoyed physics? Like
Yeah, I loved physics. Yeah. I did physics at undergrad, and I liked it enough that I went on, and then I did a doctorate as well. But by then I was sort of...
Wow, what is the title of your doctoral, how to call it, thesis?
Uh-huh. It was something like, so it was in the area was quantum computing.
Wow.
And it was something like NMR and information. So we were always advised to choose a really vague title, because you know how these things go, right? You sort of, uh-huh, you start out and you're like, I still do this when I'm submitting talks, where in my talk, I'm going to do a demo, and my demo is going to do these 16 things. And then I start, of course, I don't write the demo before I...
Yeah, of course.
Get the talk accepted, because I don't want to waste my time. And then the talk gets accepted, and then I look back at the abstract and I'm like, oh, mm-hmm, none of this is possible. I only discover when I start implementing it that it's, mm-hmm, not possible.
Should I cut this out, this portion, or should we can we keep it in the podcast?
I think it's interesting.
Well, just fun.
Yeah.
I never cut anything out, I think, here. Yeah. So, yeah. But the quantum, was it hard?
I mean... At the time, because I was sort of immersed in that world, it felt fairly straightforward. Okay. I still have my thesis now, and I look back at my thesis now, and it's just this like sea of numbers, and none, mm-hmm, of it makes any sense at all. And I kind of think, oh yeah, someone, I don't understand this. Someone, mm-hmm, else who was much more clever than me wrote, mm-hmm, this. So, but I mean, I think a lot of things, you know, when you're in it, it's easy. And then when you get separated, it's not.
Yeah, yeah, I found my script from my study, math. It was like super plain stuff. It sounded cool, but I had no idea what it is. So it was actually cool stuff I did back then, but I couldn't even remember that I did it. So it was interesting. But you had to code, right? A little bit at least, or not in your...
Yeah, and so I had... There was sort of two kinds of coding. What was mostly required was I ended up doing a ton of work in MATLAB. So, mm-hmm, it was kind of scientific computing rather than programming, mm-hmm, but you know, it's fairly similar. It's a DSL for math. But what I also ended up doing, which wasn't at all required for my research, was my research ended up sort of being about a technique for error correction. Mm-hmm. And the domain that you're working in is rotations on a sphere. So if you do, uh-huh, like more rotations on the sphere, then you can end up canceling some of the errors out. And that kind of is quite hard to sort of get your head around unless you have a visualization. And so I thought, well, I'll do some visualizations for this. So I sort of wrote the software that would, you know, do the visualizations on the sphere to sort of show how the error correction worked. And then I was like, oh, but you know, I think I really need some shading on the sphere. So I put some shading on the sphere. And then it was sort of, you know, the rotation was like a path on the surface of the sphere. And I was
this
like,
this is how Doom happened, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Because I was like, what I'll do is instead of having the flat path, I'll have like a bit of a shape on the path. Uh-huh. So it's like, you know, that there's sort of, you know, it was like you were doing it, mm-hmm, with, you know, icing, mm-hmm, or something, you know, that it had a bit of a shape. And then I was like, okay, so now I need to ray trace, you know, this curved path, mm-hmm, that I've put on the sphere. None of this was in any way required. Mm-hmm. And that was what eventually led me to think, you know, that maybe computer science was the way to go rather than physics, because everything that I was doing, I was like trying to sneak programming in.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, well,
which language was it? Java?
Yeah. I learned Java to do that.
Joggle? Was it OpenGL or what?
Oh, no, I can't remember, to be honest. It was, uh-huh, yeah, I can't remember, because it was like Java 1 or Java 2. It was,
wow.
It was super early Java.
Interesting. So you look like 30, so it just is impossible, right?
So. Yeah, it was a little bit longer than that.
Okay. But interesting story. There was a woman in my workshop maybe 10 years ago, and I did some, I don't know, I said something against JavaScript and rounding errors, and she said, it is absolutely possible. And I said, why you know this? And it turned out what she did, it sounded similar, but it's completely different topic. What she did, she worked for an institute in Greenland, And what she did, she calculated, she corrected the maps, because there was no maps. Because what I learned back then is, depending on the country, if you have a map, it's flat, but country is obviously not flat, it's 3D. So you need the corrections. There was no correction for Greenland, and she did it in JavaScript. And she attended my workshops. Like, why are you attending? It's like, because you would like to know Java. It's like, okay, that's cool. But I mean, it was crazy what she did. So it was a really interesting project. And she implemented the calculations, or I don't know how to call it, the formulas for Greenland to have a correct, you know, distance calculations on the map.
Oh, wow. So,
yeah, it's similar to your sphere stuff, you know, and path and so forth. I imagine it's a similar problem.
Yeah, that JavaScript is not the language I would have chosen for that.
No, but she had to do this because of, I think it was in browser or something, open maps.
I forgot about that,
but there was a specific, she had to do this in JavaScript. And what I told is, back then it was JavaScript, I think there was no integer, right? So everything was a float. So you had to be careful if you do some money calculation. Let's say, okay, this is hard in JavaScript. And she told me, yeah, it is hard, but she does it all the time. It's like, what are you doing is JavaScript? And told me the story, which is actually a cool story, right? So
yeah, that's very cool.
So, and you are, how to call it, physicist, right?
Physicist, yeah. Well,
physicist.
I was, yeah.
Physicist who actually coded 3D Java with JDK 1.1.
Yeah, this is like that.
This is like I would, as a Java developer, would do something with Albert Einstein. This would be the same story here.
No.
Help Albert Einstein, you know, to verify the M multiplied by C square or formula.
Yeah.
Why you enjoyed physics?
I think because, I mean, so I looked at, I sort of, when you compare it to the other sciences, chemistry is a lot of memorization, and it's
and exceptions, right? There are always exceptions. So this is what.
Yeah.
So I tried to learn something, and then they told me this time it's different. It's like, why? Because it is like it is. Like, okay, I don't like it, right?
Yeah, I remember I had to do first year chemistry, and we had some exam or test or something. And then afterwards they came to us quite sheepishly and they said, you know, oh, we have to, we're going to adjust the grades and we're going to reduce the denominator by one because there was one question that we don't think anybody could have gotten. And the question was, what color, you know, you do a such and such and such and such, and what color is the powder? And I think what they assumed is that everybody would just make an educated guess that the powder is white because the powder is almost always white. And in this particular case, they just happened to have been really unlucky and they chose, you know, some chemicals that turned out to be a pink powder. And so they were like, okay, well, no one was going to know that. So they had to take it away. But yeah, it's sort of exactly that. There's like a lot of memorization and then some exceptions. And biology was just like all memorization.
Okay.
But with physics, it's there's obviously, a little bit of memory, but so much of it is just about reasoning. And it's about, you know, I have this information. How can I solve this problem? What information do I have to solve the problem? And if you forget some of the formulas, you can almost always sort of, if you have time, rework them out from first principles and then recover.
Okay. So, almost like programming, almost.
Yeah, very similar, I think.
Mm-hmm. But it's also very similar to math, right? I would say.
Yeah, very mathematical. I mean, it's applied math, really.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Pretty cool. So, so you started computer science once again? Or what happened? Yeah, you did?
So, no. So, I was self-taught, which I think is one of the really lovely things about our industry, is that people do come in from so many different backgrounds, and that they really bring something. So some of the sort of, you know, the best colleagues I've had have had, you know, English backgrounds or philosophy backgrounds or, you know, lots of maths and physics, but then, you know, biology as well, like all these different backgrounds. And I think it really makes us stronger as an industry, which isn't something that you could say for like medicine, for example. Like you'd never want to go to a doctor's practice and they say, oh yes, well, we're all self-taught and you know that makes us better doctors. You'd be like, I'm just gonna go.
Yeah, but in
else.
Germany we have so quasi doctors who are not doctors. There's different name for it, you know, and
really
they have like, this is not a science, this is it is like you can go there and they didn't study medicine, and but they, I don't know from where they know stuff, and they apply different things, you know. That's a different story. Okay, but you're right. Usually in the typical medicine, it is like it is, right? So there is no...
Yeah, the sort of the certifications and that kind of thing.
So how you learned, so you just stopped, you ever worked as a physicist?
No. So I did the doctorate, and then I sort of realized that like everything that I'd been doing, I'd been sort of trying to like turn it into a computer problem and a programming problem. And then I was like, well, maybe instead of like trying to like get paid as a physicist while doing computers, I could just get paid to do computers. So I applied to IBM and they accepted me. And so I started working at IBM. But of course it was, I taught myself Java, but I sort of turned up at IBM and there was so much stuff I didn't know. And like, cause there's all the sort of the computer science concepts mm-hmm. that I didn't know, but then there was a whole bunch of industry stuff that I didn't know as well. So it was just sort of in the early days of application servers. And so I sort of, you know, started working on the WebSphere team, and I didn't even understand like, what is an application server? Why would anybody ever want an application server? What mm-hmm. problem is it solving? And I had computer problems as well, because I've always been a Mac person. And so then when I joined IBM, obviously, you know, this was way back when. Yeah. So they gave me a ThinkPad and it ran Windows, and I looked at this and I was just like, what is this? This makes no sense. I can't use this. This is terrible. And eventually, I was having to get help with like the most basic things, because I couldn't use the operating system of my computer. And they must've been thinking like, who is this person? She doesn't know anything about computers. She can't even use her own computer. But eventually, after about 6 months, I worked out that I was allowed to install Linux. So I installed Linux on it, and that was a very happy day.
And you're still using Linux right now?
I'm not, no, because at the time I was using Mac and no one else was using Mac, because it was before OS X. But then when OS X got introduced, of course, Mac suddenly became such a desirable platform for computing and software and stuff. So I was one of the, I sort of got lucky, and I think I made enough noise that I was one of the first people in IBM to sort of like get an official IBM Mac, because people were sort of like bringing their own Macs into work and stuff. And eventually they were like, okay, well, we'll start supplying Macs.
Okay, cool. And what you did at the beginning, so you were like evangelist for, or DevRel for, no?
No, not at all. I stumbled into that kind of by accident. And it's never actually been my official job. It's always been kind of something that I've done on the side, sometimes sort of over the protests of my management, and sometimes, you know, with the sort of the encouragement of my management. I joined just as a developer on the WebSphere team. We were working on kind of a product that was, it had like a schema for events and some infrastructure for moving the events around, as in not like events like a messaging or a Kafka where you're sort of trying to like send small messages around the system, but more like in a sort of a logging kind of infrastructure way of like, let's have a record of what's going on in the system, and let's come up with a model to be able to describe what's going on in this quite complex system. So it was just like a huge, huge piece of XML that got handed around. I don't think that product still exists, but I could be wrong.
SOA or something like this. Sounds like SOA, WS, dev stuff.
Yeah, it wasn't quite. So the product was called Business Event Infrastructure, so okay. BEI. But
okay. You ever work with Erin Schnabel, maybe?
I do, yeah. We worked together for a long time. So I didn't start working with her until I'd been in IBM for a while, because I sort of, you know, I moved around various projects. But when Liberty started, so I wasn't in the sort of the very first group of people who were working on WebSphere Liberty, but when the team expanded a little bit, I was sort of in that. I was like one of the first in the second group. So I came in and started working with Erin. And yeah, we worked together for, I don't know how long. Yeah, maybe like 5 years or so, and then we stopped working together directly, and then we sort of are now working together again on Quarkus.
Hey, cool. I remember I've met first time Erin on Java One. I think IBM was there, but it was one of the last Java One in Moscone Center. And I had a question regarding Open Liberty. I had to use it in project, and I think what I wanted to do is just deactivate some plugins, and it didn't work. And I went to the booth, IBM booth, and it was Erin, and I assumed it's like marketing person. And I asked her, you know, maybe you know someone who can help me with the Open Liberty because of some trouble with the configuration. And she asked me, do you have VI? And I say, yes. And she opened my terminal, fixed the problem. It's like, it's done. I said, are you a developer? Yeah, of course. I was like, okay, sorry. I assumed like no problem. This was like, no, this was Erin. This is like actually 5 minutes. This was the best experience, booth experience ever. It was the Java one. Yeah. And IBM booth. And then I remember still she did some game on, like a game back then, and yeah. With Open Liberty, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And Open Liberty was crazy. Yeah. It was very lean and small. And it was smaller what I usually did because back then I used Glassfish and Open Liberty was smaller. And even I like it more than Thorntail, for instance, because Thorntail was a little, yeah, it didn't make any sense from my perspective. But Open Liberty was interesting back then.
Yeah, the sort of the thing I find really interesting about Open Liberty was I think in a way IBM got quite lucky with the timing, because when they started Open Liberty, the problem that they were trying to solve was developer experience, mm-hmm. Because the sort of, you know, a traditional web sphere was, you know, super, super capable, but it was not small. No. You know, of all the things you would say about web sphere, small is not one of them. And it was
patch
really
of the EGB container took over 1 gig. I remember that exactly. And I asked, this is impossible, because I knew in Glassfish the entire EGB container was 700K. And I assume we can do this, and the developers in the project, we cannot do it right now. So can you patch? Why you cannot patch the EGB container? Because it's too big. It's like, how too big? And back then, the internet was slower. So it took, you know, the entire launch break just to download the patch. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So optimized for something that wasn't size. And it was really optimized for the ops experience. Mm-hmm. But it meant that, like, for the WebSphere developers, of course, it was hard because it wouldn't really run very well on our laptop. And for developers programming against WebSphere, it wouldn't really run very well on their laptop. And so they're like, okay, well, we've got to fix this. Mm-hmm. And they, in order to fix it, it really had to be completely re-architected. And so they'd sort of, I think they tried a couple of times to come up with like alternatives to WebSphere internally. And, you know, they just didn't succeed because they were so different mm-hmm. that it was too big a jump for customers, because then you'd say, well, we've got this great new thing. And mm-hmm. customers would say, well, how do I move to it? And like, well, you throw everything away. Well, no. And so with WebSphere Liberty, what they were able to do was they were able to completely change the core to this OSGI-based core that allowed it to be modular, which allowed it to be small and fast. But then they sort of kept the libraries like around the edge so that the behavior was, the ops experience was really different. But in terms of the application behavior, it was really similar. And the point of all of that was to allow developers to run WebSphere on their laptop, because mm-hmm. the cloud wasn't really a thing when it was, mm-hmm. when they were starting it. But then of course their timing was really good, because almost immediately after doing it, they realized that they had this really strong requirement to support applications running in the cloud and for that kind of environment. Because, you know, if you've done your provisioning and if you've bought a machine, you don't really care how many resources, mm-hmm. certainly, you know, the certainly not physical footprint, yeah. The application server takes, yeah. because you've paid for the machine. But as soon as you're in that kind of cloud environment or a virtualized environment, it matters a lot. Mm-hmm. And so then they had this need to have something that would start fast and that would be small. And it was like, oh, hey, luckily we have just written that exact thing for another purpose.
And it has a great feature. I remember what Open Liberty or still able to do is like save the entire state to be moved around, right? So it can capture the entire configuration and state into, I forgot, maybe a jar even. So it can move it from machine to machine easier. And I also ask, you know, why this feature is in place? Again, because there was the cloud requirement, and this was just implemented for the cloud. So after the business event processing engine, what you did in IBM, what was the next assignment? So I'm curious.
So I spent a couple of years. I moved from that team, and I spent a couple of years. Well, actually, I had sort of a very brief period where I got moved to do a JMS port to .NET. But it was not a very happy experience because I was there with my Linux machine, and this was before Mono was sort of a thing, but like you certainly wouldn't use it for anything serious because it was so incomplete. Mm-hmm. And so I was there with my Linux machine trying to do .NET programming. And so I had to do everything, you know, via VNC. And it was just, and again, you know, it was just, there was so much friction because I didn't have the tools that I wanted to be working in. So I did that very briefly, but it wasn't a very happy experience. And so then after that, I moved to the team that was building the JVM. And so I worked in the performance team there, which was super good experience to learn a bit about performance. But I ended up doing a thing that I think probably all of us do, but I definitely catch myself doing, which is that, you know, you change the assignment. So like when I was doing my PhD, I turned it into let's draw pictures. And when I was doing the performance work, I did the same thing of sort of turning it into let's draw pictures, because I was doing garbage collection performance, and you know, you get these vast logs and you have no hope of being able to make any kind of understanding of what's going on with the garbage collection unless you can visualize them. And at the time, the JVM was what turned into J9, and it didn't have, you know, you couldn't use the normal JDK tooling because the logs were in a different format, so we needed garbage collection analysis tooling. And then, so I sort of wrote some tooling and then that ended up taking more and more of my time. And then we sort of expanded the scope of the tooling as well, so that instead of just looking at garbage collection, you could look at the sort of the health of the whole system. So it was really sort of an alternative to mission control, but for J9, called Health Center. And if you're using J9 now, it's quite possible you're still using Health Center because it's still.
Is this UI, user interface, Health Center?
Yeah.
They knew. I was not aware of that, so I will try it out. So is this similar to JMC a little bit? Java Mission Control?
Yeah. So, similar idea. And I remember at the time, the really cool thing about Health, that in the Health Center architecture, it wasn't my idea, it was someone else's, but one of the things it would do is it would give you profiling. Mm-hmm. But normally when you're doing profiling, you have this sort of unpleasant choice, which is you can profile everything and that gives you a really complete picture, but you've introduced so much overhead that you've possibly changed the performance characteristics of the machine enough that the problem you were looking for isn't even there anymore.
And definitely, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you definitely couldn't leave it on for long because it's so expensive. Or you do sort of a more targeted profiling and you say, okay, well, I think that the problem is in this component, so I'm only going to turn on profiling for this component. But of course, we know that's exactly what you should not do when you're doing performance, is you really shouldn't try and prejudge where in the system the bottleneck is before you've got some evidence for that. And if you're looking at the sort of the method level, then you really kind of want to have profiling evidence for that. And so what the profiling in Health Center did was, because we were in the JVM team, we realized that the JIT is already doing the exact profiling we need, because the JIT needs to know what methods are hot in order to compile them more aggressively. And so all we did was siphon off that existing information that the JIT was collecting, just dump it out, you know, send it over the wire and then dump it out into a UI. And then we could have these really low overhead, like 1 or 2% always on profiling. So it was really cool.
This is similar to what JMC and Hotspot does, actually. This was the JRocket project at Oracle. And at Oracle, this was, JRocket was a Swedish company, I think. And Oracle bought it and they merged it with the JDK. And this is similar. Didn't know that the OpenJNI does the same. It's actually a cool story.
Yeah. And yeah.
So now, when Quarkus gets new UIs, I assume you are working on Quarkus. So we can expect very soon a user interface from you, right? Because you're changing your assignment as well.
Well, it's kind of, I mean, it's kind of already got one. And it's not me who's doing any of it. So we've, you know, Quarkus has its dev UI.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, sort of, I because it's always been there, I kind of take it for granted. And so then when I talk to people about what they really like about Quarkus, the dev UI is one of the things they always mention. And I'm sort of like, but of course it has to have a dev UI. Why wouldn't it have a dev UI? But of course not everything does. And it's, yeah, the dev UI is certainly super useful as a way of understanding what the server is doing and managing it.
Mm-hmm. After OpenJ9, so you created the UI, so you were done with J9, mission completed.
Yep.
What happened afterwards?
Yeah, more or less. So then I from there I sort of moved back into the WebSphere team. And I worked on a project that was one of those projects that seemed like such a good idea at the time, and it never really, really took off, which was the project itself was called Apache Ares, and then we did a WebSphere integration. So we did all the upstream work, and then we did a WebSphere mm-hmm. integration. And what the problem Apache Ares was trying to solve was, I really love JEE. I really love those APIs, and I really love OSGI, and there's no compatibility or interlock between mm-hmm. those APIs at all. So let's do enterprise OSGI, which gives you those same ideas of, like, you know, JPA and that kind of thing, but in a way that's compatible with OSGI. So we worked on that for a couple of years. I wrote a book about it. But it sort of eventually became clear that, you know, this was not going to, because OSGI is so powerful, and there's some problems it can solve really well, but of course there's other problems that OSGI makes harder, which isn't ideal. And so that, you know, that does make it hard to sort of, you know, get really widespread adoption if some things you make hard. There was a lovely saying about OSGI, and it was OSGI makes the impossible possible and the possible hard, or something like that. So,
I didn't like the OSGI at all.
Really?
No, because I always used application servers. I never actually implemented them. And I have complete understanding that something like Glassfish 3, for instance, or Open Liberty, they have to, or JBoss modules, they need their module system. But in enterprise project, there is no business mention of a module usually, because back then our business people, they, you know, you got the complete requirement, and it was really hard to know what varies or what can be replaced. So there was no notion of, you know, of replaceability or modularity. So if you deliver the project, you were basically done. And at the same time, architects loved OSGI. So we got lots of OSGI modules, especially in Eclipse RCP back then, without any reason. So we had projects with no 20, 30 modules and with ugly class loading hacks. I remember there were even problems with logging. Simple logging didn't work because of OSGI. And there was hack like a body class loader. Like you have to expose stuff that the two modules can share and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I say, why you are doing this? Like, because of modularity. It's like, yes, but it will be never replaced. So give me a single use case where you will replace one single OSGI module or update one OSGI module in the project without touching the others. And there was, in my project, there was never the case. So I wanted to build monolithic systems, which then later became microservices, basically, because my monolith was still small. And back then, I didn't call them monolith. I called them microservices, and now I call them monolith because they are. This is like, you know, a few hundred classes in a module, and it works perfectly well with modern Java. So this is why I have complete understanding that you had to use OSGI to implement Open Liberty or even Quarkus. I wouldn't be surprised. So Quarkus, of course, there is no notion of OSGI at all. But if Quarkus would decide to use OSGI internally, I would say, okay, understandable. But I'm glad how Quarkus works right now, just flat hierarchy and no magic at all. But this is what back then, interestingly, I got lots of questions from the Sun team, I remember, about enterprise OSGI. They asked me, you know, Glassfish on OSGI, maybe there was some cooperation with IBM, or I don't know. And I say, I don't understand why you need it. And I was actually also sad that said that Glassfish 3 was so modular because Glassfish V2 was a monolith. So it started quickly, and I always wanted to have the complete Glassfish. I had no on my project. I didn't want to introduce unique snowflakes in my project. Mm. I wanted to have one server, exactly the same server for all of my clients. This was always my idea. And the idea of OSGI, that one client will have this 3 module and the other client, this 5 modules, I couldn't get it at all. And even in Quarkus right now, I try, just to use the smaller RAI extensions first. And so almost all my Quarkus projects are identical. And I try to avoid the Quarkiverse extensions. If there is no reason, I wouldn't use it. Right? Mm. So this is the idea right now. Interesting. I didn't know that you wrote a book about that. And you liked OSGI back then? Or was it like mixed feelings?
We used to have the thing that OSGI does so well is protecting your internals. So we used to have this problem that we would, as soon as you make a class and it's there on the class path, people can find it and use it. And then that means that your ability to change that class is gone, mm-hmm. Which can be a real problem on a long-lived product with lots of users, because every class someone's going to find. And so then you change it, and then they come back to you and they say, you've broken me. And we go, well, that was a private API. And they go, well, I found it. So if you didn't want me to use it, you shouldn't have let me see it. And we used to have the same problem cross-team as well, because, these were big products that had multiple teams working on them, in different sites, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And so you would find an API and another component that did what you needed, or rather you would mm-hmm. find a method in another component that did what you needed and be like, well, it's there, I'm going to use it. And then it would destroy their ability to make changes. And so you'd end up in this the system would just become so, so fragile, because anytime anybody removed a method or changed a signature or that kind of thing, it risked a break. And so then we had to have so much expense on testing to try and catch these things. And OSGI just allowed us to be so clear about, these are our externals, these are our internals. And I think you can sort of see that need as well when you look at how popular microservices became. And the OSGI community got really annoyed when people started talking about microservices, because OSGI has this notion of a microservice, which is kind of an in-process service. And mm-hmm. there's a infrastructure around discovery and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that's fairly different from microservices in the conventional sense, I think. But I think the problem that cloud microservices were solving was exactly that modularity problem of, I want to keep my internals internal. Mm-hmm. And they decided that the way to do it was to, do all communication over the network. Mm-hmm. And that comes with so many costs.
Absolutely.
And so I think it was one of those cases where we could have actually solved that problem of, can I keep my internals private without having to introduce a network barrier as the barrier. We could have just introduced a class loader barrier instead, and that would have allowed us to solve the same problem with a much lower operational expense.
The problem is your arguments are reasonable. So I tell
if
you a story.
I ruled the world.
Yeah, I was at a Java user group meeting, and they asked me, you are a software developer, and we have hundreds of microservices, and we have a trouble starting them in the right order. And I asked them, how big is your team? And they told me, 3 developers. I said, okay, but why you have so many? And the answer was, we thought this is the way to go. They read the articles, and everything was about microservices. So, okay, in your case, I would maybe implement 2 at most, right? And usually it's obvious if you need a microservice. It's usually a complete different life cycle. In one project, we encapsulated in a microservice all the payment providers because they changed frequently. So it was obvious to us, to put this in one microservice, and the other microservice was the ordering logic. And this was, I think, fine. But in this project, they just implemented lots of microservices without any reasons. And I saw this a lot. And what I did is I merged them to a monolith, and everyone was happier than before. Yeah. And with OSGI, it was similar. It was like, developers in a room or in a single building. And they started to implement abstractions, factories, reflection to decouple from each other. And the problem you get there is you can always compile it, but you are not sure whether it will work, right? So it's okay, just remove all the reflection, all the interfaces, factories, And if you rely on a method and someone changes the method, you get a compiler error. This is actually a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
And so this is actually interesting because in my application software development or business software development, we have complete different requirements. So what you are explaining. And both, you know, our arguments are still valid. You know, my arguments, hopefully, and yours as well. And but it's getting better and better. I think the recent projects are more reasonable, but still 5 to 10 years ago, it was crazy what you saw. No, lots of there are so much code, and then they wanted to have a higher code coverage, so they implemented reflection tools to call everything automatically, just without a searcher, just to calling getters and setters and whatever, just to get higher code coverage, which is funny. Yeah. So.
Yeah, I my first microservices project, I looked at the tests, and this wasn't because it was a microservices project. It was just the developer skill, but it was exactly that they had a test suite that just had, it didn't have any assertions, and the coverage was good, but there was no assertions, and it had exactly that problem as well that you're describing, that the effect of the way it had been modularized was just to move errors to runtime from compile time, which, as you say, yeah, is not good. So we had to introduce contract testing, and that helped a lot, because then at least it meant that we discovered the errors early in the test cycle rather than, you know, in production. But it was it had this really complex domain model, and because it had been modularized into microservices, the domain model had to be replicated into every single microservice.
Yeah.
And so then that we just had all of these domain objects, and every time there was a change in, you know, the dream of having duplicates is that you can make changes in one and they don't have to be in the other one. But the way the application works, the way that, you know, the business problem was if you made a change in one, it had to be in the other, but you didn't get that compile time alert. And you had to do double the work with a hugely increased risk.
Yeah. What after the what we talk about was the OpenJ9, then you move back to Open Liberty with Enterprise OSGI. And what happens then? So after, so you recognize that it will never happen, the Enterprise OSGI, or what happens with the entire story?
Yeah, it wasn't actually me. It was, you know, the sort of the benefit of being in a big company is sometimes your career decisions get made for you. So that project sort of was winding down and didn't need the same level of investment as it had when it was new. And Liberty was starting up. So a bunch of us got moved to the Liberty team. So I got moved to the Liberty team, which was great because it was, you know, it was a fantastic project. And I worked on Liberty for about 5 years. And then I did something quite different, which is because all of my career I'd been sort of on, you know, on the product side, away from users. And then I switched to services. So I worked as a consultant for 5 years. And again, this was sort of, you know, the cloud was really just taking off, but a lot of businesses didn't know how to get to the cloud. They didn't know how to move their processes from how they were doing them to something that was more cloud native. And, you know, those really heavy processes just don't make any sense in the cloud. And so I worked on that for 5 years. So that was really fun because we were also really trying to help users adopt the sort of the most leading edge technologies. And so we were always sort of looking at the IBM catalog and you know, what was new in it, and then, you know, sort of helping customers use it. So that was really cool.
The cloud native story, I also never got it, because you remember there was from there was the 12 factor.
Yeah.
And if you read this, it was obvious, or at least in our project we did it for years, so there was nothing special. The only thing was that you configure your system from the environment variables, basically. So this was this is what you could easily do even with JBoss back then. It's not like something really strange. I think even JBoss had to substitute the variables, so you could absolutely do this. Quarkus does it all the time on various levels. So if someone asks me, I heard, you know, Java is not cloud native. So like, what do you exactly mean is not cloud native? So I mean, it can run in a cloud without any problems. So what do you expect maybe in the cloud, right? I think what does make any sense is to have an admin console, which is active in the cloud, because you would like to manage or start and stop the instances, like a nodes, and the entire configuration you provide from outside. So this is the only difference. And maybe the expectation that the runtimes are shorter lived. This is the expectation. It's nothing wrong that WebSphere can run for years. You know what I mean? So the entire discussion with cloud native really confused me back then, because I said, okay, what's different? Because if you do it right on premise, no difference to cloud, right? Both is a virtual machine.
Yeah, I liked 12 factors because it was sort of clear and prescriptive, and I didn't agree with every factor, but you understood what you were talking about. But cloud native, the term became so popular that I think at one point people forgot that they were allowed to say cloud. You know, you could say, I have a cloud app, but nobody ever did. You know, anytime you said the word cloud, you had to add native onto the end. And so then the meaning just became so diffuse. So, you know, I heard people talking about migrating their applications to be cloud native. And I was thinking, but cloud native, you know, the original sense used to mean born on the cloud. And so if you migrate your application to be cloud native, by definition, it's not born on the cloud. And by definition, you know, it could be really well behaved on the cloud, but it couldn't be cloud native. But that was a battle.
But the 12 factors, lost. So I opened them. This is the first one is code base. One code base tracked in revision control, many deploys. So we always did it, right? I would say the last 15 years, I would say, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a good practice, but it didn't always used to be. And
yeah, true. You're right. But yeah. as the 12 factors came out, for Java, it was already true.
Yeah.
Because since I think Subversion migrations were in 2006, and since then it was true. Before that, not always, there was strange stuff. But since Subversion was around, I think everyone did it. You know, there's even before Jenkins, there was cruise control and all the stuff. So there was, Then dependencies, explicitly declare and isolate dependencies. I would say, with Java EE, we also always had it, right? So proper Java EE system. So we had Java EE APIs. This was the golden rules, and we tried to avoid any other dependencies. Then the third rule is config. Store config in the environment. So this is the change, because before cloud, there was nothing in environment. This was actually strange to keep anything in environment. It was considered as a hack, usually XML or sometimes database. I remember everything was in XML, and if you store something in a database, it was some unusual, something cool that you can do this, right? Yeah. Then one strange one, backing services. Treat backing services as attached resources. And this means like HTTP communication, I guess. This is how we understand that. Treat backing services as attached resources. It means, JDBC. It's such a resource, right? So it was, this is,
Yeah, I never fully understood that one.
Yeah, it's strange because if you read this, I did it in my workshops back then. And this is, a backing service is any service that the app consumes over the network as a part of a normal operation. Examples include data stores, MySQL, CouchDB, and so forth. Which in our case, it was JDBC from JDK 1.1, problem solved. So we had connection pools. It was attached service, but yeah. Number 5, build, release, run. Strictly separate build and run stages. I think we also had it in Java, right? So with Jenkins and Hudson even, I mean, this is old stuff. One is interesting. Number 6 is execute the app as a one or more stateless processes. And this is maybe different, stateless, because back then we had Java server faces, remember? And there were sessions, and now sessions are back because of chats. It's exactly the same like HTTP session. But back then, this was stateful, and there was huge discussion whether it is good or bad, where to put the state, I remember. So this was at least, there were lots of discussions and architectures. But right now, I would say 90% of Quarkus applications are stateless, or 95 or 99, right? So this is it is unusual to keep state inside Quarkus, right? Or even
I think so. I mean, I don't have that good picture of the usage, but that would be this my expectation.
What I can tell you, I can remember that we ever deployed a Quarkus application with state. So highly unusual. port binding is interesting. Export services via port binding, which you were forced with Docker, right? Because you had to map the ports before Docker, maybe, right? So concurrency is interesting. Scale out via the process model, which means AWS Lambda is cloud native. Anything else, everything else, maybe not. This is what I would scale out via the process model means. If you have new traffic, you start new processes, which is highly inefficient, I would say. Back then, everyone was proud of that. But now, even recently, Lambda became multi-concurrent. So I would say it was a big feature that Open Liberty and all our runtimes were highly efficient within a process, right? Even Loom, or what we have right now, the virtual threads. We can run on a single JVM millions of threads, which is a feature, not a bug. So this was the number 8. And this is like, they mean that way. And they say, for example, PHP processes run as a child process of Apache. And okay, this is the number 8.
And I guess it's sort of a question about how much you want to invest in multi-tenancy as well.
Yeah.
So as soon as you get more complex things, then you know you end up with your multi-tenancy breaking and it can be quite expensive to fix. Do you want to do that, or do you want to just say, look, let's just be single tenant? And it might be that a single tenant is serving multiple things, but it has, you know, some distinctiveness that makes it a tenant. And we just say, if we want another one, just use virtualization, just start another process.
This is actually what I do in hardcore stateless or serverless projects. So what we even do is that every client in some projects gets an own account. So we have own account with own Quarkus and everything isolated, own data store. So this is single tenant, highly isolated. Yeah. But they meant process, which is okay. But this is how, you remember CGI? So this was like CGI started a process per request from Apache, Common Gateway Initiative, I think. And serverless with Java became famous because we could do this as threads, which was far more efficient.
Yeah.
The number 9 is disposability and says maximize robustness with fast starting and graceful shutdown, which is perfect for Quarkus. So,
indeed.
Or Open Liberty, right? Back then, was even Open Liberty was already great.
Yeah.
So keep development, staging, and production as similar as possible. This is what I also see. And this is where I don't like dev services a lot. I try, use Quarkus the same everywhere. So, but but LGTM, for instance, the Grafana stack observability is great in Quarkus that it starts the, and everything, they can test it locally. But usually, for instance, before I start Postgres locally, I will like to have it defined somewhere. So keep development, staging, and production as similar as possible. The number 11 is treat logs as event streams, which is now true, right? Because if you have write in a cloud, it's usually one event is a log statement. And if you have Loki or something, Grafana, the events. And admin processes, run admin management tasks as one of processes, which is interesting because in the cloud, there are no more admin processes. So you have infrastructure as code. So I would say a little bit outdated, but if you read this, I would say 80% of my old on-premise projects were like that without knowing that there is a 12-factor apps. This is why, because it was using the arguments against Java, saying, look, I don't understand. So, and I never heard a good explanation what it actually is. But this was the cloud native era. And right now, I would say every Hello World Quarkus application is cloud native per default, right? I would say this is like,
I think it would it'd be very hard to make it not.
Yeah, this would be cool conference talk, actually.
Yeah.
How to build a non-cloud native applications. What to do to be not, I couldn't even, what to do. I don't know. XML.
Like so much of it is so instinctive.
Yeah.
That I think it would be really hard. Like even the stuff like, if I start just a stupid toy project, I start doing git commits, don't I? You just have that habit and the idea. It is something that we've learned as an industry, and it's not automatic to everyone. It's just automatic to us. And I really saw this a couple of years ago when I was working with data scientists, and the way they worked made all the software engineers just kind of like scream, because there'd be things like exactly like the bad old days of software. They'd sort of do some work and then they'd push it from their local machine to production, and then they'd go away. And if there was a problem, you couldn't actually get the code to fix it because it was only on their local machine. And there was no kind of, there's no idea that having the code not on your laptop might be helpful to the team.
This may be not weekend native, right? So this yeah. not native weekend. So because if they are on weekend, then... Okay. This was the cloud native. So, but you were IBM consultant, right?
Yeah.
And you delivered any Java user group talks ever?
Yes, I've done. So I've done a few for the London Java community, and I've done a bunch in the Netherlands as well. Because the Netherlands, as far as I can tell, has about 600 Java user groups. They have one for every resident.
And Switzerland as well?
Yeah, I don't think I've done one in Switzerland actually. Oh, maybe I have. I've
because
done one,
and
I've,
have you ever had blue hairs?
Oh yes, yes. There was yes, I did one for the Paris Jug many years ago, and I had blue hair, and I hadn't realized that they had sort of done a little promotion before I turned up, where they invited their members to also turn up with blue hair. So I turned up, and I had a whole bunch of people with, and I was talking, and I had a whole bunch of people with blue hair looking at me while I was talking, which is very flattering and very funny.
Then we clarified a mystery for years, because I delivered a talk in Java user group, I think Switzerland or Netherlands, something like this. And someone told me before me, there was a woman with blue hairs, and she had similar opinions to mine, but she used Open Liberty back then. And I said, who could it be? And he couldn't remember. So after yeah. years, I know you were you, and you yeah. delivered a talk with similar opinions or topics to my talk. I have no idea what you said back then, but you used Open Liberty. And I for sure used, I think back then, maybe Glassfish or JBoss, not Quarkus. It was earlier than that. So we clarified that. So, yeah. So you are the consultant with blue hairs.
That's really funny. Yeah, that was
yeah, this was really funny. Because he was so convinced, like, this is great, Open Liberty. He was very excited. I was like, who was it? He couldn't tell. But she had blue hairs. Like, I don't know anyone with blue hairs. Who could it be, you know? And I scanned, you know, the entire internet and never found anyone with blue hairs. And you were this. So we clarify that. What happens after the consulting years?
So so after that, I moved across to Red Hat. So that was Aaron's fault, actually. Because Aaron was working with the Quarkus team and said, oh, I know someone who would enjoy this. And so I moved across to Red Hat and joined the Quarkus team. And that was about 3.5 years ago now.
Okay. So you're working for Quarkus right now?
Yeah.
And what are you doing with Quarkus? What is your area of expertise?
So it's a little bit of all sorts of things. So what I was brought in for was some of the sort of the community aspects and the Quarkiverse aspects. And I've done some of that. But what I've also done is sort of take that idea of ecosystem and switch it from one of people to a more environmental one. Because one of the things about Quarkus, you know, as we've discussed, is it's extraordinarily efficient. And we kind of knew that it was more efficient, and we knew that you would save costs by running on Quarkus, but we didn't have any measurements to sort of convert that into carbon. And, you know, we had this intuition that it would be. So I led some measurements that confirmed that Quarkus is indeed much more energy efficient. And then as sort of from that, that snowballed a little bit. So now what I'm doing as well is I'm sort of a cross-portfolio sustainability architect for that middleware portfolio. So looking at sustainability across a bunch of the products to say, well, how is this sustainable? What architectures could we choose that might be more sustainable? What UX things could we add that would allow users to do some of the things that might make their applications have lower energy costs, like, you know, deferring work and that kind of thing. So I'm doing a bunch of that, but I'm also doing a whole bunch of class loading and dev services work, which sort of ended up falling out or coming through from a combination of that microservices work that I did as a consultant when I was, you know, so horrified by some of the instability and lack of resilience that the microservices had, combined with the ecosystem brief that I had when I joined, because I said, in order to understand the experience of Quarkus extension authors, I need to write my own extension and publish it to the Quarkiverse. And we had a gap because the PACT contract testing framework kind of worked with Quarkus, but it didn't work in every situation. And it certainly didn't take advantage of, you know, the sort of the value add that you can get with Quarkus in terms of like the DevUI integration and that boilerplate reduction and dev services and all that. So I said, mm-hmm. Well, I'll write a PACT extension. And then when I started writing the PACT extension, I realized that going from the sort of that first level of it works with Quarkus to that next level of it really integrates deeply with Quarkus and takes advantage of what Quarkus has to offer wasn't actually possible with the way Quarkus tests had been architected, just because of sort of, mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same with OSGI, that as soon as you go into class loading, at some point your head starts to hurt. And so then you have to hope that the architecture is designed in a way that you never have to look at the class loading, which in Quarkus, I think it mostly is. But if you wanted to get lower into that level of, I'm going to write an extension and it's going to hook into the test framework, you started to have to touch the or understand the class loading. So I re-architected the class loading so that it allowed test extensions to do more and be more Quarkus-y. And that took quite a while. And so then after that piece of work made dev services a little bit more annoying and a bit more inefficient if you had a whole bunch of test profiles, because it meant that instead of starting each dev service when you needed it, we would start all of your dev services up front, which if you only have one instance of Postgres, that's fine. But if you have like 10 profiles and each one declares its own Oracle database and all of those 10 Oracle databases start at once, that starts to become a problem. So we're just in the process of of using a sort of a new infrastructure to start the dev services so that they start when you actually need them rather than eagerly. Mm-hmm.
And I saw your commit recently, and what I did, I used the LGTM dev services stack and dev UI. And what happens is the Quarkus starts, you know, the Grafana, Loki, and so forth in a Docker container, but with random ports. And there was a bug. And you solved the bug, because I read, you know, in the issues, and I say, Holly, you know, solved the problem there. And this was like the most recent Quarkus version solved the bug, because my use case was I wanted to start one microservice with the Grafana stack and the other microservice reused the already existing Grafana stack. And this was not possible before, because Grafana used dynamic ports and the configuration in Quarkus had no effect. So you could do this, but there was no... And seems like you solved my problem a few weeks ago. Hurry. And I assumed, yeah, that you are working for Autel or Grafana, but it didn't make sense because of class loading. It was a class loading issue, I guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was because of the dev services. So now the sort of the most of what I'm spending my coding time on is dev services. And that's that thing, isn't it? That once you get in and once you get the sort of the context and the flow, then you end up fixing lots of other dev services problems that weren't the ones that you sort of initially.
So we can expect actually dev services UI, a new one, right? Like class loader visualization user interface.
Ooh.
This will be a cool assignment, you know, if we change.
That would be cool. Although yeah. I think we're probably, there's more class loading changes coming. Because my colleague David Lloyd has been looking at making Quarkus integrate with the JPMS system, and that carries That's a whole cool. bunch of I think it would be really nice to have, but because Quarkus is opinionated about class loader hierarchy and then JPMS is quite opinionated, I think, you know, it's not trivial. And for at runtime we have a flat class loader hierarchy, so that's fine. But then when we're in dev mode, we have a much more complex class loader hierarchy. And David noticed that what was happening was every time we had a problem to solve, we would just add a class loader. So I can't remember what the number was, but we had like a lot of class loaders in the code base. And so I think he's going to be on a bit of a mission to try and simplify our class loading, which is really good. And then that hopefully should make the integration with JPMS less of a heavy lift.
I have to invite you back. Two topics. One is you explain us about class loading, what Quarkus does with class loaders, and sustainability and energy savings. This is what I'm really interested in, because the interesting part is energy saving correlates with money savings usually. Yes. Because and this is a big topic of mine. This is actually the reason why I run 100% Java in the cloud, because of cost savings. Java is incredibly fast, and this is why you can save money with Java and with Quarkus. So, we have to talk again.
Yeah, I call it the double win, that you sort of, you know, you might set out to save money and then you also end up saving the world along the side, which is, you know, a bit of a bonus.
You know, Job Runner,
tool? Yeah.
We had a chat and he said, okay, what he can do with Job Runner is I think it's De Huse is his last name, and he can save CO2 by running the jobs, delaying the jobs, you know, if there's spare capacity. So, okay, it is interesting, because usually you can also save money. So this is how it does it, because if they know that the price gets lower, it usually means there's less demand. So you can have both, which is really interesting, right? Very similar to accessibility, by the way, right? So accessibility is interesting for disabled people, but even more interesting for power users, because, you know, shortcuts and so forth in using interface, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Super cool. It was nice to chat with you, and we clarified the mystery with blue hairs after 15 years or something. This was like, you know, it's like,
it's really funny.
Where people can find you on the internet?
So I've got a website at hollycummins.com, and so I try and blog regularly, and I completely fail, but there are some blogs there, and then you can also find all of my recent talks and links to podcasts like this as well.
And Quarkus Insights, right? This is also
Quarkus Insights.
Is there a weekly show?
There is, yeah. Yep, so we do Quarkus Insights once a week. I don't actually put that on my website, which is, I probably should. But yeah, we do Quarkus Insights once a week. So if you look for Quarkus Insights, we live stream on Mondays at 3 p.m. European time. And then it's available on YouTube forever as well.
Okay. Thank you a lot, and see you next time.
Yep. Thanks so much. See you, Adam.